Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
I was one of many people that were victims who was used by somebody who was psychopathic.
Let's tell this story.
World of Secrets, Season 2, The Disciples. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is an updated edition of the Global News podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Charles Haviland, and at 4 hours GMT on Friday the 12th of January, these are our main stories. The US and the UK have carried out military strikes against Houthi rebel targets in Yemen. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says hypocrisy and lies are behind the court case at The Hague, in which his country is accused of committing genocide in Gaza. Researchers say they've found the ruins of a vast ancient city in the Ecuadorian Amazon that changes everything known about the history of the region. Also in this podcast,
one of my vendors was selling something else, and she said at the end of the conversation, "I've got a couple of friend scripts. Do you think they'll sell?" And I, of course, went, "Yes, yes, bring them in, because I love friends."
25 years after they were thrown in a bin, original scripts from the hit US sitcom are up for auction. Israel's three-month war against Hamas in Gaza has increasingly been making waves in the wider region, and nowhere more than in the Red Sea, where the Houthi rebels, who control much of Yemen, have been retaliating against Israel by attacking cargo ships with drones and missiles. Hundreds of shipping companies have been forced to divert vessels around the Cape of Good Hope, a much longer route and far more expensive. A US-led naval coalition was deployed to the Red Sea to protect ships, but the Houthis paid no attention. Now, by night, the US and Britain, supported by Australia, Bahrain, Canada and the Netherlands, have carried out missile strikes on Houthi targets, reportedly hitting the capital Sana'a and the port of Hodeidah. The White House confirmed the strikes in a statement.
"These targeted strikes are a clear message that the United States and our partners will not tolerate attacks on our personnel or allow hostile actors to imperil freedom of navigation in one of the world's most critical commercial routes."
Our Washington correspondent, Will Vernon, told me more about the Allied military strikes.
We heard in that White House statement that these strikes were, according to the president, successful and a direct response to what he called unprecedented Houthi attacks against international shipping. We shortly thereafter heard from the US Defense Secretary, Lloyd Austin. He said that the strikes targeted the Houthis' drone and missile capabilities, as well as coastal radar and air surveillance systems. And the Reuters news agency said that there had been a number of explosions, quoted witnesses saying they had seen and heard explosions in several different cities, and quoted a Houthi official who also said that there had been strikes on a number of cities. And this comes amid repeated warnings, as you were saying there in your introduction, from Western officials, that if these attacks on international shipping do not stop, attacks on one of the most critical shipping routes in the world, then there will be serious consequences. And I think that's what we're seeing tonight.
Indeed, there have been warnings. But on the other hand, for weeks, the Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, has been trying to calm things down, most recently in his latest tour of the Middle East, which is just winding up. He's saying he didn't want the conflict to spread. So isn't this really a massive U-turn?
You're right. Secretary Blinken is just returning now from his latest Middle Eastern tour, and he met a number of leaders during those visits, including the Saudi Crown Prince, the Israeli Prime Minister, a number of others. And his stated aim on that tour was to try and avoid this conflicts between Israel and Hamas from spreading, from dragging in all kinds of regional players. But I think the narrative that we're going to see play out in the next few days is that this is a defensive mission. Indeed, we've just heard from a senior administration official here in Washington who said that we have no doubt that ships would have been struck, perhaps even sunk, including in one case, a commercial ship full of jet fuel, which is quite a frightening prospect, isn't it? So I think that that's going to be the messaging from the White House, from the Pentagon in the next few days that the US was forced into this in order to protect itself and its allies?
Well, a Houthi leader in Yemen, Hussein al-Ezzi, has confirmed the attacks and warned the assailants will pay a heavy price. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia has said that the attacks are a cause for great concern. The Houthis are heavily armed. I asked our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, how effective these allied strikes might be.
I don't think the Houthis will be overly worried about American, British military action. They've weathered quite a considerable storm from the Saudis since 2015, when the Saudis intervened in the war in Yemen. The year before, the Houthis had taken power in the capital city and controlled a good part of the country, as they still do, including the coast and the ports on the Red Sea. I've spent quite a bit of time with the Houthis in Yemen, and they're defiant. They go their own way. They're also very religious. Their slogans include death to America, death to Israel. I think they want to be in the fight, actually. And they have said that they are intervening because they're supporting the Palestinians against their great enemy, Israel.
Given that position the Houthis take, that they see themselves as acting on behalf of Gazans in the face of the Israeli attacks, how much or how little support in the region might any Western-led military action over the Red Sea situation attract?
Well, it's going to have quite a bit of support, clearly, in Israel. It's going to have quite a bit of support in Saudi Arabia, in the corridors of power, in the palaces of the ruling family, and in the other ruling families' palaces, I think, in the Arabian Peninsula. However, polls in Saudi Arabia have suggested that the vast, vast majority of Saudis are very pro the Palestinians, very, very against what Israel is doing. And so I think they'll be happy seeing Houthi defiance. And I think the perception of what the British and the Americans do militarily will be among people in Arab countries and others in the so-called global south, you know, a bit of an unfortunate phrase, but sort of tells its own story, will be here they are moving from diplomatic and logistical support for Israel to actually entering the war on Israel's side. I think many people will see it that way too.
So what might then be the repercussions?
I think that actually there's a lot of fear about the war spreading, but what we have to say is the war has spread. It's happening. The only bright spot in all of this, I suppose, is that it's still at a relatively low level. It could get much worse, but it has spread. It's not just spreading to the Houthis, Yemen. There are pro-Iranian militias in Iraq and in Syria who are attacking the Americans who still have troops there. There's everything, of course, that's happening around Gaza, and there is an increasing risk of an escalation between Israel and the Lebanese militia political group backed by Iran, Hezbollah.
Our international editor, Jeremy Bowen. Jonathan Marcus is a defence analyst and military expert. I asked him if these allied strikes will hinder the Houthi attacks on cargo ships.
It obviously depends on the number of targets hit and the success of those strikes. We imagine that over recent weeks, the United States and its allies have been building up as best they can an intelligence picture of the military infrastructure at the Houthis' disposal. So we would expect targets to have been launch sites, possibly radar installations, missile storage facilities, maybe command and control facilities of some kind. The danger, of course, is if the Houthis do not halt the attacks on the shipping lanes in the Red Sea, then the question is, are the United States and its allies going to launch a kind of rolling air campaign against the Houthis to try and force them into submission? And that, of course, risks a significant widening of conflict in the region.
What do you think will be the main obstacles, militarily speaking, that the Allied forces might face? I've heard that the Houthis have kept a lot of their armaments very much concealed, and they're used to deploying them over the course of nearly the past decade.
Well, absolutely. And the Houthis are not newcomers to the use of many of the weapon systems that they're employing. They engaged in quite a successful missile war against Saudi Arabia. It's possible, for example, that they could try to attack American installations in Saudi Arabia or elsewhere in the Gulf using long-range missiles. That's quite possible. Obviously, they could step up missile attacks against the Israeli port of Eilat. quite apart from continuing attacks against shipping in the Red Sea. So there are lots of things they can do. Now, obviously, the Western warships have proved very capable so far in shooting down a range of Houthi weapons, from unmanned drones to ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, and so on. Of course, all of the warships carry a relatively limited number of interceptor missiles, so there will be logistical questions for the United States and its allies to keep the arsenals of their warships topped up. Once again, when you embark upon military action of a kind of punitive, dissuasive kind, you have to wait and let the dust settle to see what the impact is. But I frankly think it's unlikely that the Houthis are simply going to back down after one series of strikes.
The Houthis are very strong allies of Iran. Is there a danger Iran may get sucked in any way?
The Iranians will be wary about being drawn in themselves, but I think they'll also be very happy if the Houthis can continue to prove a significant irritant to the United States and its allies. And of course, the biggest irritant, if you like, is not necessarily the direct military threat. It's the implied threat which affects commercial shipping, with the commercial shipping lines rerouting their vessels, going around Africa, taking longer, costing more money, and potentially damaging Western supply chains and Western commerce. So, you know, the stakes here are very significant indeed.
Jonathan Marcus. And now, with the rest of the Global News Pod, here's Janat Jalil.
Israel's Prime Minister has described accusations of genocide against his government as being based on hypocrisy and lies. Benjamin Netanyahu was speaking after South Africa, whose ANC government has long supported the Palestinian cause, outlined its case to the UN's top court, alleging that Israel's military offensive in Gaza amounts to genocide. Mr. Netanyahu said listening to the first day of arguments in The Hague was like being in an upside-down world. He insisted that his country was in fact battling genocide by Hamas after the massacres of October the 7th.
A terrorist organization committed the most terrible crime against the Jewish people since the Holocaust, and now there are those who come to defend it in the name of the Holocaust. What audacity!
But lawyers for South Africa told the International Court of Justice in The Hague that Israel was acting with genocidal intent. According to Hamas officials, the war has killed 1% of the population of Gaza in 3 months. The South African Justice Minister, Ronald Lamola, accused Israel of intentionally unleashing suffering on civilians in the Gaza Strip.
The world has watched in horror as Palestinian men, women and children were slaughtered, blown up, buried alive under the rubble of their homes, left to die painful deaths and in unresourced hospitals, resulting in over 23,000 deaths through destruction to homes, schools, hospitals, water, treatment plants and other public infrastructure.
The Genocide Convention was enacted in 1948 in the wake of the Holocaust. It defines genocide as acts committed with intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnical, racial or religious group. Our diplomatic correspondent, Paul Adams, considers whether South Africa will be able to prove that Israel's offensive in Gaza meets that threshold.
The last 3 months have been shocking enough, but to hear it all summed up by South Africa's lawyers is still devastating. How, many wonder, can this not be a story of genocide? But the 1948 definition, which so accurately describes the horrors of the Holocaust that had so recently ended, is an incredibly high bar to clear. The South African team knows it has a legal mountain to climb. There has to be evidence of intent by those responsible for Israel's military campaign. And there has to be a pattern of behaviour by its troops which cannot reasonably be explained as anything other than genocidal. Israel will make its case. Its high-powered delegation includes Aharon Barak, Israel's former chief justice and himself a Holocaust survivor. The implication, perhaps, Israel understands the true face of genocide. It'll be 3 or 4 years before the court decides whether Israel is guilty. But much sooner than that, perhaps within weeks, it could demand that Israel halt its military campaign to avoid inflicting further harm on Palestinian civilians. Israel, determined to pursue its goal of destroying Hamas as a political and military force, would almost certainly ignore the court's ruling. There's nothing the ICJ can do to enforce it. But a judgment by the UN's top legal authority could add to the pressure mounting on Israel to change the way it acts in Gaza.
Paul Adams, Many of those killed in Gaza have been children. The Hamas-run health ministry says 40% of those who've died have been under the age of 18. But even before the current war, those growing up in Gaza had lived through multiple rounds of fighting between Palestinian armed groups and Israel. Back in 2021, the BBC reported on a girl called Nadine Abdul Latif. Now 13, she's become a popular vlogger and has been describing how during this conflict, her brother was killed during an Israeli airstrike and her family forced from their home. Here's our BBC Middle East correspondent, Yolande Nell.
That is the sound we hear every night. Did you hear that?
Hunkered down in her apartment, this was an Instagram video by Nadine Abdul Latif in the early days of the war.
The block around us is being attacked. We don't know which building is going to be under attack, but a lot of people out in the streets are screaming and we are not sure what's going to happen.
She filmed her world being shattered, her neighbourhood of Gaza City pounded by Israeli bombs.
This is my home. This is my home. Look how it looks like now.
Soon, like hundreds of thousands of others, she was forced to flee towards the south.
We've left our houses three times, from Gaza to Al-Wusta and to Al-Wusta to Rafah.
Now, Nadine tells me of her own terrible loss in this war.
Losing my brother was the worst moment of my life. I mean, he was my dear brother. He was everything that I love. He was always by my side. We would always go out together. Out there from the war and after all this time, I just want you to stop.
During a previous conflict in 2021, school was cancelled and Nadine began making videos for social media. One clip of her, distraught by the rubble of her neighbour's house, went viral.
I don't know what to do. I'm just 10. I'm just 10. Children stand all day and wait for them to be able to get water for their family.
Again, during the three long months of this war, Nadine's been showing the trauma and struggle for children, who make up half of the 2.3 million people in Gaza.
I saw these two children selling cans of food in the rain. They might get sick, but this is our life.
And there are the daily indignities.
As you guys can see, I'm still in the same clothes because there's no water. I can't take a shower.
Nadine's long hoped to be a doctor, but now she can barely contemplate the future.
It's not living anymore, just existing. We don't have hopes anymore. We don't go to school. We don't do anything. We just sit here and watch and do the stuff. Just exist. And that is horrible.
Every day feels dangerous in Gaza. And with so much grief and devastation, even when the violence stops, its young generation will find it hard to pick up the pieces of their lives.
Yolande Nell. The former US President Donald Trump has reiterated his belief that his civil fraud case is a political witch hunt on the closing day of the trial in New York. Mr. Trump has already been found guilty of inflating the value of his properties to secure favourable loans. The trial is looking at other counts such as conspiracy and falsification of business records. Our North America correspondent Neda Torfik sent this report from outside the court.
In court, Donald Trump's lawyer echoed the former president's claims. Chris Keiss said the case had been manufactured for political reasons and that the attorney general was trying to put Mr. Trump out of business. He argued that the accusations didn't make sense because Deutsche Bank had rolled out the red carpet to give Mr. Trump loans, that he didn't need to inflate the worth of his assets, and the loans were paid back. The judge has banned Mr. Trump from addressing the court himself because he's failed to agree to limits on what he could say. So the former president made a statement outside.
It's a witch hunt in the truest sense of the word. It's election interference. And so it's all a conspiracy to try and get Biden, who can't put two sentences together, trying to get him into office. So I just want to let you know that we have our best poll numbers. We have the best everything despite this, and maybe because of this, because the people of the United States, all of those people back there, but the people of the United States really get it. They get it better than anybody else.
Judge has previously disagreed with the defense. He said lenders could have been damaged by lending at a lower interest rate than they would have if Mr. Trump's assets had been valued correctly. Prosecutors argue that the former president used a myriad of deceptive schemes that were so outrageous they belied innocent explanation. The judge will issue a verdict at a later date.
Neda Torfik. Now to the tiny, unspoilt Caribbean island of Barbuda. Some residents there fear that the arrival of new multi-million dollar tourist resorts and an international airport will threaten their culture and way of life. Others see them as bringing much-needed jobs and development. Caroline Bailey has been to Barbuda, the smaller of the two island states of Antigua and Barbuda, to find out what the future holds for this island paradise.
From a beautiful pink sandy beach, environmentalist John Mussington points out two private resorts at either end of Barbuda's southern coast. It's known as the Barbuda Ocean Club, and they're building hundreds of multi-million dollar residences and a golf course.
Luxury properties are built, golf courses are going to be built. Sale of these luxury properties and put them behind fence for persons living private lifestyle will mean large areas of resources we depend on for livelihoods will no longer be available to us.
John is worried about the environmental impact, as the larger of the two resorts is within an area declared by the Intergovernmental Ramsar Convention as a wetland of international significance. The developers leading the project, the American firms PLH Barbuda Limited and the Discovery Land Company, declined our request for an interview, but said in a statement that the project was approved in a transparent and inclusive process, and that they're doing a lot of environmental work, including restoring wetlands, and also that they've created hundreds of jobs for Barbudans. But John has taken the government to court over another aspect of the project, the construction of an airport in the middle of the island, which he says is in an environmentally sensitive area.
No proper environmental impact assessment was done. And when an impact assessment turned up, the review by the Department of Environment said it was totally inadequate.
The case has been heard at the Privy Council in London, Antigua and Barbuda's highest court. If John wins, he'll have the right, that's been denied to him, to challenge the project and call for a judicial review, where a judge would look at the lawfulness of the process. But others, like local businesswoman Kelsina George, who runs Barbuda Cottages, see the high-end resorts as good for the island's economy.
They've hired a lot of Barbudans. All the young people, everyone went to work there. And from what I gather, they're pretty happy with the money.
And that's what the government based in Antigua says is the priority. Charles Fernandez is the Tourism and Investment Minister.
Well, I think it's a vision of the government to bring Barbuda to a level where it has full employment. Barbuda is going to generate, when it's fully operational, is going to generate a tremendous amount in taxes.
Barbuda is not alone. Around the world, there are similar battles taking place as small paradise communities in beautiful locations attempt to balance economic need against protecting their own cultures.
Caroline Bailey reporting from the Caribbean island of Barbuda. Still to come,
scientists use both excavations and ground-penetrating lasers to find these vast remains in the Amazonian rainforest in eastern Ecuador.
The huge ancient city, believed to have been built 2,500 years ago.
Some people play golf on the weekends. I hunt con artists.
Unmissable podcasts from the BBC World Service.
Our County Mayo, a great team blighted by mystical forces we can't comprehend.
I believe in the curse. I think it's real.
Telling stories from around the globe.
Every minute there's bombing and shelling. There is no safety. If I get any internet connection, I'll talk to you again.
Search for Lives Less Ordinary, Amazing Sports Stories, and The Documentary, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You better be ready, because we're going to bring it to you.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Tens of thousands of opposition supporters have held an anti-government demonstration in the Polish capital, Warsaw. The rally outside Parliament was called by the Law and Justice Party, which lost elections last October. The demonstrators were protesting against the new government's imprisonment of two former ministers who've been convicted of abusing their powers when they headed an anti-corruption agency. President Andrzej Duda had pardoned the men for the crimes in 2015. But last year, the Supreme Court ruled the pardon was invalid, something the president disputes. As Adam Easton reports from Warsaw, he's now started the process to once again pardon the two men.
Tusk to prison, the demonstrators chanted.
They mean Donald Tusk, the country's new prime minister and political enemy number one of opposition law and justice supporters. Many of them are angry about the way Mr. Tusk has started undoing the controversial reforms of the law and justice government that recently lost power after 8 years in office.
I am a Pole and I think what's happening harms Poland and is illegal. Above all, taking over public television and imprisoning people who have parliamentary immunity and forcing the president to pardon them again.
She's talking about Mariusz Kamiński and Maciej Wąsik, who were convicted last month of abusing their powers when they led an anti-corruption agency. After a court ordered police to take them into custody earlier this week, they briefly sheltered in the presidential palace at President Duda's invitation. President Duda refused to recognise the court ruling, saying he'd already pardoned the men for the crimes. But his original pardon was legally disputed. As the men said they were starting a hunger strike in prison, President Duda said he would issue a fresh pardon to allow them to be released.
Adam Easton in Poland. The jailed Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny has long complained of the harsh treatment he receives in prison, being frequently put in a punishment cell, being denied access to medical treatment, and even attempts to poison him. So his supporters were alarmed when he disappeared for several weeks at the end of last year. They eventually tracked him to a remote penal colony in the Russian Arctic. This week, in his first public appearance since then, he's told a Supreme Court judge by video link that he should be allowed access to proper meal breaks and more books in prison.
You, comrade, said that I have 10 books, and there are religious books among those 10 books. I need 2 books for the constant practice of my religion. My religion is Orthodox Christianity, and any representative of the Orthodox religion will tell you that more than 1 book is needed for daily practice. 1 book is not enough for me. This violates my religious rights. It violates my rights to study.
I asked our Russia analyst Vitaly Shevchenko how Mr. Navalny appeared during the court hearing.
Well, he looked haggard, which is not surprising given the circumstances, but also both when he appeared via video link from his Arctic colony on Wednesday and today on Thursday, he looked upbeat, he was smiling, he made some jokes, which of course will be a source of inspiration to his followers and supporters. And also it will ease the concerns and fears which emerged after Mr. Navalny disappeared in early December and none of his lawyers and supporters knew where he was. So he's back. He is reasonably well, as far as we can tell. He is able to continue to argue his cases in court. So today his case was focused on prison rules, such as the limit on the number of books inmates can have in their cells. And also, he complained against a prison rule which said that you have only a certain amount of time to consume your hot meals. And according to him, that amount of time, in practical terms, was usually reduced to 15 minutes. And he said that inmates burned themselves because they were in such a hurry to eat their meals. And unsurprisingly, those complaints were rejected. So he's been able to achieve very little with his cases, but at least he's trying.
And he's also showing them that he remains defiant, that the Russian authorities and these draconian conditions that he's been kept in have not broken him.
Which I suppose is the reason why he was sent to jail in the first place. Mr. Navalny is arguably Russia's most active, prominent and effective opposition figure. And now he's in jail, which means that President Putin is the only man on the top who will be able to run for re-election later this year. All of his effective and credible opponents are either in jail, such as Mr. Navalny, or in exile, such as almost all of Mr. Navalny's supporters, or dead, such as Boris Nemtsov, who was shot dead outside the Kremlin.
Vitaly Shevchenko. The Thai government says it will continue to allow a former prime minister who's supposed to be in jail to serve his sentence in hospital. Officials said Thaksin Shinawat still needed close medical attention. Mickey Bristow reports.
The billionaire businessman was initially sent to prison when he returned to Thailand from self-imposed exile last August. The 74-year-old was almost immediately transferred to hospital, complaining of tightness in his chest. The government, run by a political party linked to Mr. Thaksin, says he can stay at the luxury medical facility, just in case he needs treatment. The former PM is serving a one-year jail term and is eligible for parole next month, so he might never see the inside of a prison cell again.
Mickey Bristow. Now, cast your mind back to some of the supply chain problems during the COVID-19 pandemic. A key concern was the availability of semiconductors, those computer chips so vital for many of our electronic items. Well, since the pandemic, geopolitical tensions have also affected this industry, with 90% of the world's most advanced chips made by TSMC in Taiwan. So it will come as no surprise that countries all over the world are now investing billions of dollars to try to make their own supply. Hannah Mullane visited a new factory near the city of Durham in northern England. There she met David Moore, the chief executive of the Pragmatic Semiconductor Company.
We get started?
Yeah, let's start it.
Go. Okay.
Let's go this way.
First, I had to put my safety gear on. Does it matter that I can't put my helmet on my head with these headphones on? You could get me a very large one.
After we managed to find a helmet big enough to accommodate my head and my headphones, we were ready to go.
Well, welcome again. So this is Pragmatic Park. This is Pragmatic's newest manufacturing site for flexible integrated circuit technologies. So unlike silicon, we make what is a ultra-thin, very flexible, low-cost, sustainable alternative to those silicon chips. These are essentially 8 inches wide, and so they got a certain number of chips to it. You can see the tiny little rectangles there. Each of those is a chip. And so what's really special about it is that it's flexible.
Yeah, and I'm feeling it, and it feels like the kind of film I might wrap a Christmas gift in or something.
Yes, yes, you
it's
could.
It's really
right,
very
right, for those really nerdy family members who want semiconductor wrapped Christmas gifts. No, absolutely. It is that. I mean, ultimately, what it's laid on is essentially what's called polyimide. It's just basically a plastic.
This is like a big dinner plate and a small side plate,
I guess,
in terms of size. It just feels crazy to think that there is so many chips in that can be used in tech. It doesn't feel like tech when
yeah.
I look at it. It doesn't feel like
absolutely. So
metal things going into phones and things like
exactly,
that. You know I mean?
Exactly.
It's quite a different thing to see in person.
It's extremely unique. So that thin film technology enables it obviously to be flexible and really thin. So a silicon chip in your cell phone or your laptop, they have their role to play. But if you want to be able to embed these into products that need to be flexible and integrated into smart packaging and those applications, that kind of flexible, thin form factor is a really unique thing.
It's the flexible nature of these chips, which means they can't be used in all the same places that you might find the silicon kind. It's more likely that we'll see them in wearable health technology, for clothing authentication and in parcel labels to track and trace items. And for such tiny items, you really need a huge space to make them.
Walk this way. It's pretty big, isn't it?
This is a 16,000 square meter building. Obviously, it's got a feel of a very industrial kind of facility to it. And it actually is formerly was a ceramic pipe factory. And so it's large. On a 15-acre site, we've got, the 16,000 square meters. Ultimately, the secret behind this is the ability to be able to take what is just, a general site here in the Northeast and be able to put semiconductor manufacturing into it. But if you take a standard silicon, manufacturing facility, first of all, they're going to be gigantic. So, many times the size of this. It's going to take multiple years and billions of dollars. Typically, too, silicon fabs will require a huge amount of energy. So TSMC, for example, uses 5% of Taiwan's total energy supply every year. They use hundreds and hundreds of millions of liters of water. They have to use very kind of complex chemicals and gases. Because of our unique processing, it's ultimately more simple And that makes it, you know, fundamentally more sustainable.
David Moore, the chief executive of Pragmatic, talking to Hannah Mullane. A huge ancient city has been found in the eastern Amazon. Scientists had previously thought that large settlements were only in highland areas of South America, like Machu Picchu in Peru. Georgina Ranard reports.
Scientists used both excavations and ground-penetrating lasers to find these vast remains in the Amazonian rainforest in eastern Ecuador. They believe they were built 2,500 years ago. The city had around 6,000 mounds and platforms that made up homes and places to conduct ceremonies. They were connected by many kilometres of long, straight roads. Little is known about the people who lived there, except that they were farmers and their diet included sweet potatoes and sweet beer. It's not known why the civilization ended, but eruptions from a nearby volcano probably played a part.
Georgina Ranard. Original scripts from two episodes of the hit US sitcom Friends are going up for auction 25 years after they were found in a bin. The scripts were meant to be destroyed to stop details of a season finale leaking out before it was broadcast, but a worker on the set rescued them and has kept them in a bedside drawer all these years. Their value has been estimated at about $1,000, but as Joe Black reports, they could sell for much more.
The scripts belong to one of Friends' most famous episodes, which entertained millions in the 90s and early noughties. In it, Ross is marrying his British fiancée, Emily, but he messes up his wedding vows and says, "I take thee, Rachel," the name of his on-off girlfriend throughout the series, drawing gasps of horror from the assembled guests.
What have we got here?
So, two frame scripts, the one with Ross's wedding, filmed at Fountain Studios and in central London.
Some of these scenes were filmed in London, and now the scripts, which were originally found in a bin after filming, have been discovered 25 years on. They'll go under the hammer. Amanda Butler is from Hanson Ross, which is holding the auction.
One of my vendors was selling something else, and she said at the end of the conversation, "I've got a couple of Friends scripts. Do you think they'll sell?" And I, of course, went, "Yes, yes, bring them in, because I love Friends." And she worked at Fountain Studios. She found them in a bin, picked them up, took them home, and they've been in our drawer for 25 years. The great thing about these scripts is that the cast and crew were told to destroy them so that the ending wouldn't be leaked. And they're here.
The auction house has received many calls.
That report by Joe Black. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chris Ablakwa. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janet Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.